Welcome to EIR Talks. On August 31, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche gave the keynote address at the Labor Day Conference of the International Caucus of Labor Committees and Schiller Institute, convened in Reston, Virginia. This week, part one of the keynote is presented as the first of a series of programs dedicated to this historic conference.
I want to welcome you and those who are on the internet. Apologize for this brief delay, but it was unavoidable. I welcome you to the Labor Day Schiller Institute Conference. My name is Nancy Spanas, and I'll be chairing the first part of this session. We are about to begin a historic weekend. As the personal invitation you received from Lyndon LaRouche said, Hoover too has happened. We now face the decisive moment as to whether we're going in the direction of a new Hitler regime, an empire worldwide, or to an FDR-style solution under the leadership of LaRouche. And your activity coming off this conference will be decisive in this matter. But I want to add another dimension to our deliberations this weekend. Just 2 days ago, the Schiller Institute issued a renewed call for this conference in the form of a tribute to one of its board members, William Warfield. Renowned baritone William Warfield died on August 26th, but as our tribute, written by the 50 years young Dennis Speed, put it, William Warfield is not dead. He resides in the beauty which he knew and created, and often created for us, especially in opening sessions of our conference. His ability to stimulate and create that idea of beauty and classical art is an inspiration and necessity for us to replicate in the months and years to come. In the latest issue of the New Federalist, you can read this tribute to William Warfield. And I want to add a brief remarks that were made by George Shirley, another leading baritone at the occasion of Warfield's passing. It is written we should all rejoice when one of our brothers or sisters returns home. Since we are all prodigals wandering this earth in search of salvation, leaving the world and its pain and injustice behind in order to return to our Father's house should be cause for rejoicing. This is especially true when the earthly journey has been as productive and notable a triumph as has that of William Warfield. Rest assured that although silent to our mortal ears, save for those moments frozen in time by the miracles of audiovisual technology, the great voice of William Warfield now rings forth robustly in heaven, in chorus with those of Hayes, Anderson, and Robeson, and will ever resound in mortal memory. Mors Janua Vitae, death is the gate of life. Thank you, Bill, for so richly blessing us along your journey back to the promised land. We look forward to hearing your glorious voice again when we, in turn, re-enter the portal of life eternal. With lasting admiration, George Shirley. Now to proceed, I give you Schiller Institute Vice Chairwoman, civil rights heroine Amelia Boynton Robinson, who will introduce our leader and keynote speaker, Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you so much. A tribute to William Warfield. God needed a songbird in heaven. and God took William Warfield away. He only loaned him to us. And we know wherever he is really giving a beautiful, beautiful recital to the angels in heaven. We all are on our knees and on pins as to what is going to happen. America has really lost her cool, as the young people say. And she's very much like a schizophrenic person. Unfortunately, like people who don't think deeply, she has refused to listen to the voice that comes from above, the conscience that has been gathered throughout the world, the person who understands and who knows what has happened, comparing it with what is going to happen, and living in a time that is happening. It is unfortunate that because of greed and because of money and because they are getting to the place that the oligarchies want to be seen and want to be heard, they have turned their backs on those who have made them what they are. They've turned their backs on those whom they are supposed to guide and to lead. And they have gone after the material things of life. And because of that, the masses of people, the people, suffer. And when I say the people, we are suffering. The whole world is suffering. And everybody is on pins because they don't know what's going to happen later on. And we think about enemies. Who are our enemies? All we have to do is to look around. We don't have to go beyond the oceans to find out whom they are. And we know, as you read the papers, the bickering that is going on now, even among the Republicans. And a whole lot of that is, who's going to accept what I say? My plan is better than your plan. Consequently, I will not agree with anything that you are saying. We need to listen. We need, as members of the organization, as visitors, as well-thinking people, we need to go into the highways and byways and tell the story, the real story, the truth of what is happening, and try to avoid what is going to happen. That is very important. We know that we have one with the experience, one who has told the world just what we should do. And the interesting thing about it is, other countries have sit, listened, accepted, and are doing the things that are helping the country to get out of the chaos that they were in, helping that their people will be able to have jobs. The infrastructures are on the way everywhere else but America. And yet, a man who is born here in the United States of America, a man who has protected this country by giving to the United States under our former presidents what should be done, and they have refused to listen, all because of the fact that they want the honor and the glory, and they want their plans and their programs to go through. It reminds me of something we used to say. Yes, they have left us out. They have left us out because of the fact that we will destroy the corruption that is going on in this country, the bringing drugs into this country and feeding it to the poor and to the weak, whether regardless of color, creed, denomination, or servitude of birth. But it is not going to last long, because we're going to either destroy this country or we are going to have to accept what our speaker has to say. They drew that circle because they who are living like a parasite on others don't want to let a loose. And it reminds me of the circle that they have drawn. They drew a circle and left us out. Heretic rebel, a thing to flout. But Schiller Institute, Lenin LaRouche, and those who understand have drawn a larger circle, and we are going to take them in, because they are going to have to come to the conclusion that we are right than anything else if they are going to live. And I present to some of you and others who might know the greatest man that we have here, who, if America and the world are going to be saved, this is a man that God has ordained to bring the message and to save us, Lyndon H. LaRouche. Come on, darling. You know, you are out of faith.
Thank you, Amelia. And you watch that girl you're with. She needs a lot of watching. Those of you who are present here, and those of you who are listening, and many others, are frightened. You're either frightened in the sense that you admit you're frightened, or you're so frightened that you can't face it and try to deny the reality of what you are now experiencing in the United States and in the world at large. So my first job is to point you to the way to find your courage to deal with something which has not been seen in European civilization in a long time. Something which has not been seen in European civilization since the 14th century New Dark Age, where a third of the population of Europe was wiped out in a few decades by bankers who insisted on collecting the full value of their debt, which was a swindle, at the expense of the lives of the people. We are in a situation now in which the government of the United States, the financial powers of the United States, the leadership of the two major parties are presently committed to repeat now, in the immediate future, what the Lombard bankers and their political backers did to Europe in unleashing the new dark age of the mid-14th century. You're living in a time where you face the fact, if you are conscious of the fact, that every nation on this planet could be swept away almost as if it had never existed within a few years from now. Not merely because of the aftermath of an unthinkable, foolish war which a stupid president is impelled to launch against Iraq. Not merely because of a depression, because of something much worse, as I shall indicate. But how do we address such situations as this, where the very existence of humanity is imperiled? In Christianity in particular, there is a you have the St. Matthew Passion and the St. John Passion of Bach. Now, when these are performed with a congregation, as Bach had intended they be performed, where the congregation is responsive, the soloists, the musicians, the instrumentalists, the choruses are responsive to their parts. The participants in the event relive, as if they were there, the passion and crucifixion of Christ. And the question so posed is, when contemplating the death of Christ in that way, and the passion of Christ, what does it mean? Now, there's a dear friend of mine who is not theologically too sound, but he's a minister nonetheless, which is a usual combination these days, who says to me repeatedly and to others that Jesus died because he made a mistake. And some people say that Martin Luther King died because he made a mistake. Both are mistaken. Both died, as Christ said, and as Martin said in his mountaintop address, they died for humanity, for future humanity. And what this signifies is that life is by its nature mortal. We're reminded of that, of course, emphatically today by the passing of William Warfield. Life is mortal. It comes to an end. So that there's nothing you can achieve in life which in and of itself gives any durable value to your existence. Then what gives value to your existence? That in the course of time you come and you pass. And if you have done something which was needed in honor of past mankind and for the sake of the future of mankind, then you never die because you are an efficient part of humanity. It is from this assurance of one's sense of such an identity that people find the courage to overcome their fears, not to push them aside, to deny them, but to overcome them, as one imagines a soldier must in battle. Why would a soldier risk the life, live for life in battle, except for some higher purpose which lives beyond them? Why should anyone live a life except in service of some higher purpose which gives a special meaning to the model of existence of the person? And it's only when you think about the essential immortality of the individual personality, an immortality of that particular implication, that you can find the strength not to waver, not to turn coward, not to bind yourself to reality in face of terrible times, such as those which now prevail. Now, my job is, since this point is clear to me, and has been clear for a long time, and if it hadn't been clear to me, my enemies have from time to time reminded me of it. There's certain enthusiasm for getting rid of me. And the only constraint they seem to respect is the fear that my modern might be more dangerous to them than my living person. They would hope that I might disgrace them myself in some way and thus relieve themselves of the danger of my martyrdom. But therefore, I am confident in this, and I would hope that I can impart to you a sense of the reality of my reasons for confidence. And that you who are here or who hear me now will find in that a source of your own personal strength. First of all, the courage to see reality of what it is and not to pretend it's something different than what it is. And secondly, the courage to find your suitable role in response to this challenge presented to all humanity, that you might stand upright and proud as a human being who is making a mark for the future betterment of mankind. That even if we were defeated, we shall give such a lesson to humanity that future humanity will benefit from it. But we do not intend to be defeated. We will resort to everything needed to win. What we've entered in is not a Great Depression. Just see the first one, the Dow Jones Industrial Average comparison. I know this is just a comparison of two depressions, the most recent one now ongoing, and the preceding one of 1929-33. There was also one before that, 1922. But the difference is this depression could be the final one. And Nancy spoke of Hitler, the danger of Hitler. The danger is not Hitler. There is no Hitler on this planet now. No Hitler danger. The planet, if it chooses the pathway of Hitler, will not make it to a Hitler. It will destroy itself before it gets to that point. Some people have set out, as in the United States, as around George Bush, the people who control him, to establish a new English-speaking Roman Empire. But they made a mistake. They didn't study history. The Romans started their empire at the height of the power of Rome. Poor George Bush is trying to create a Roman Empire at the death of Rome. We've used up those sources of power on which the power of the United States had been based. Coming out of World War II as the only world power, we are now a junk heap, ready for the scrapyard. So that is not the true picture, but it does give you an indication of the fact that we are in a depression, that the President of the United States is denying it, that people have been denying it for a long time. Now look again. Look when what we have is a figure on this depression. When did it start? It didn't start this year. Look back a few years. Look back to 1996 and beyond. The next chart. Got the next chart? U.S. economy's collapse function? All right. You see here that in relative terms, in 1996, this depression was already in full swing. Right? Manufacturing employment was down. Debt was climbing about the year 2000, 1999-2000. The rate of monetary aggregate accumulation, that is monetary inflation, exceeded the rate of growth of financial values on markets. That is a hyperinflationary function. In other words, what you're looking at there is a depression already in progress by 1996, which had entered a couple of years later into a hyperinflationary function akin to that which destroyed the German Reichsmark between June and November of 1923. That's where we are. So we're not in a simple depression. We're in something much more serious. We're in what is called a general breakdown crisis. Now look at the question of the mass layoff announcements. Just see where we are. The significance is that from 2000 to 2001, the George Bush was greeted at his inauguration with an acceleration, a hyperinflationary acceleration of the rate of collapse of the depression. Then think on that. Remember that all the years that people were voting for Clinton or thinking about voting for Gore or some other foolish thing, or voting for Bush, other such foolish things, talking about prosperity. Do you remember that Gore and Bush on a national television debate, so-called debate, it was sort of a vacation, two vacant chairs debating each other. Each was asked by the same question by one of the questioning reporters, what would you do in case of an economic crisis? And they said, we would follow the advice of Alan Greenspan. They did. And that's what happened. So we're in a case in which not only are we in a depression, but we are in a very serious collapse phase of the depression. Now look at next, the question of the flow of foreign assets into the United States. The United States has not been prosperous. We could bring on some other charts, but it's not necessary. You've got them from other sources with us, earlier sources anyway. But just to make this point, the United States has not been prosperous. Since 1977, when acting President Zbigniew Brzezinski dragged in Jimmy Carter from Georgia and said, "You're president. What do I have to do?" Brzezinski said, "Whatever I tell you to do." But the United States has been in an accelerating depression, process of depression, for a long time. The Carter administration was part of it. What Carter did to destroy, to tear down infrastructure, transportation, power, agriculture, and so forth, was the start of the real collapse of the U.S. economy. The collapse of the international economy had begun by August 1971, when a perfectly workable fixed exchange rate system, monetary system, was swapped for a floating exchange rate system, which was the beginning of economic hell on this planet. So during this period, the United States was able to appear prosperous to fools who didn't pay attention to what would happen to the lower 80% of family income brackets, to cities and to so forth, to education, to health care, whatnot. They weren't paying attention to that, but they were looking at the stock market values or the so-called official figures, while the people were getting poorer and poorer. The health care was getting less and less. The farmers were being destroyed. The industries were being destroyed. But we were prosperous. We weren't prosperous. But the people who controlled the United States were amassing financial assets and thought they were prosperous because they had financial assets. How do they have financial assets? Well, the United States had become a kind of Roman Empire. Particularly with the collapse of the Soviet system, the United States, with its Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom and Canada, which were really part of the British Empire, these groups felt they could establish a world empire, an English-speaking world empire of financier interests, speculators. So they took the occasion to begin the process of globalization. NAFTA in the United States, a project to make all the Americas together with England, an extended version of NAFTA, a slave system.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of LaRouche's keynote address to the ICLC Schiller Institute Labor Day Conference. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with LaRouche's keynote from our Labor Day conference.
1982, all of Central and South America began to be destroyed in a process of destruction which has not abated since. Now it's at the end. Virtually every country in South America is extinct or is about to become extinct, including Argentina, Mexico, Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Venezuela, Colombia, Central American countries. Mexico is threatened. There's no part of South and Central America which is not now in danger of extinction in the foreseeable near future as a result of this process. Why? Because we looted them. Africa is near extinction. Why? Because we looted it. We killed the people and went in to grab the gold, the other old mineral assets, petroleum and whatnot, the water, everything in sight. We did that. We looted Europe, our so-called continental Europe, our ally. We looted it. We looted everything else we could loot. From 1989 on, 1991, they looted the Soviet Union. They looted Southern Europe. They looted Eastern Europe. So the American Empire, like Rome, following the Second Punic War, expressed its power by ceasing to be a productive economy, shutting down our industries, things like that, and deriving our wealth by stealing it by force from other countries. South America, Central America, Africa, Europe, Asia, as much as they could. Former Soviet Union. We stole it. And we lived upon the stolen wealth. We shut down the factories and took the people who had been skilled operatives in these plants and we put them into dead-end jobs. We destroyed communities. We destroyed families. We destroyed schools. We destroyed universities. Today, the price of tuition at a university is the inverse proportion to the value of the education delivered. A university is a place where a person gets no knowledge but a lot of social status. You pay for the social status because you surely don't get education. They also propped it up by imposing upon the world our current account deficit. We not only stole from other countries, but we bought from other countries and didn't pay them. It's called the current account deficit. On top of that, our stock markets were collapsing, but we fixed that. We looted other countries of their financial assets. We induced them under pressure and inducements to send their money into New York, into the New York financial system. So they build up the system. We forced Japan to print worthless money. The worthless money printed by Japan on U.S. orders was then sold overnight for dollars or Deutschmarks. These went into the European markets a little bit, but primarily into the U.S. markets. So the Japanese yen was strangling and bankrupting itself by propping up the New York financial markets and other financial markets inside the U.S. And that's what that is about. The foreign assets flowing into the United States have enabled those who had power to believe they were rich because they, as a shrinking minority of our total population, was enjoying wealth. For example, let's take the people, how they survived in this area here. We're about to have probably something in the order of a 30% collapse in mortgages in the area of Greater Washington, Northern Virginia, and so forth. This will be a reflection in part of the dot-com collapse. People who are without skills of any merit, but who had inflated salaries, are now becoming unemployed. No place to go. They bought into plastic-coated tar paper shacks with mortgage values assessed at between $500,000 and $1 million or something of that sort. And now they're bankrupt. The mortgages are hanging out there, bundled up and propped up by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Federal Reserve System, and the mortgages are now becoming uncollectible. People in these areas, as long as the mortgages were increasing in valuation, were able to go to the bank to refinance their account and get some cash to spend on things like food and credit card debt. And therefore, the purchasing power in this area was sustained by borrowed money generated in large degree from this swindle. The Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, bundle mortgage, Federal Reserve System swindle. A similar condition exists in California. Similar conditions exist in other pockets in the United States. It's coming down. The same thing is about to happen in the United Kingdom, where you have a similar real estate bubble. So therefore, what you see as a result of this is you see that what was of the apparent prosperity or the rumored prosperity, which was reported to you by a press, a major news media, which was owned by the people who are pulling the swindle. Take AOL Online. Take your major press. Who, for example, take Citicorp. Who's the swindler at Citicorp? Sandy Weill. the same crowd, the Lazard Freyer crowd that owns the Washington Post. Enough said. You believe the Washington Post? Do you believe any? Look at the television media, the so-called news media, entertainment media. What news do you get on these things? Nothing. You get propaganda. You got a president who's not quotable, but that's good because he doesn't say much. They have governments that don't state facts. They state conclusions without attached facts and no facts in sight. So this was the illusion of prosperity over the period since the middle 1960s when the United States was already going into depression. It was a papier-mâché illusion that this was not a depression. An illusion based on the perceived power, political, military, and other power of the United States and of the English-speaking financier community. Now, as of the year 2000, the whole thing began to collapse. As I said at the beginning of 2001, this thing is gone. It's gone. So what has happened at this point, accelerated by Crazy George's idea about a war with Iraq, by George's support for Sharon, who he may hate for all I know, probably should hate, may hate, that this is driving down, driving a wedge between the United States, Asia, Africa, and Africa. The countries of Europe want no part of George Bush's war. Russia wants no part of George Bush's war. Asia generally wants no part of George Bush's war. The only government that seems to support George Bush around the world is really the Australian government. Almost no other one. They hate it. They're expressing their hatred of the United States, this policy, their distrust of the United States, and also their what they think their own vital interests by withdrawing their flow of money from the United States into Europe and other locations, repatriating their assets. So this is bringing the whole system down. And the month of September is going to be hellish for those interests. Now, take another factor here. Take this next thing on the rail industry, tonnage. Again, 1970 to the year 2000. What you see into the early 1980s, a rapid collapse, especially under the impact of the Nixon administration program. A rapid collapse under Nixon and Carter, which, or just better said, under Kissinger and Brzezinski, of non-coal tonnage. It's a transformation of the United States from the world's leading productive economy to a post-productive consumer society. We, like Rome in its decadence, we stopped producing wealth with our own people at home and relied upon stealing from foreign countries. So this is what that reflects. We've been in a long-term collapse of the entire system. You see the same thing reflected on this domestic intercity freight traffic. The same tendency. The same problem in terms of transport. Now before coming to more on transport, which is the main topic on which I want to focus in conclusion, let's look at some of the factors here. Why did we let them do this to us? Now the principle is this. The American populace will tell you that the problem is the government. Some will be the politicians. Now, a politician is a prostitute who walks the street of elections and does what he believes his customers will find pleasurable. Now, who's the boss? Who's running the country? Is it Madam Government? Or maybe Hollywood Madam Government? That the orchestration of popular opinion and popular taste spreads corruption into the people first and the politicians second. The politicians are the victims of the populists. Americans are very funny people. They hate politicians, therefore they elect them. They hate the government, therefore they elect bad politicians so they can hate the government more sincerely. The typical American populist has lost his sense of patriotism a long time ago. He wouldn't fight for anything, he would only fight to kill somebody. Typical of this kind of personality, the dual personality. The American is not a patriot. He does not see the United States and its Constitution as the founders of the nation did. To create an instrument on this continent to establish a former republic, which would be, as Lafayette later called it, a beacon of hope and temple of liberty for all mankind. This country was founded by Europeans, by the very best Europeans, who devoted their efforts to support the cause, the American cause of freedom, in the hope that by giving the United States, at some distance from old Europe, a free republic, the only place in the world it could be done at that time, was in English-speaking North America. And to give us a republic here, which, as Lafayette said, would be a beacon of hope and temple of liberty for all mankind. Thus, we knew that we needed this government. We needed this constitutional government to protect us and to enable us to bequeath something to our successors, and to do a great deed for all mankind by creating that beacon of hope which would cause mankind to rally to the same cause, to create a new order on this planet, which is called by Plato and by the Christian apostles John and Paul a nation or state of affairs based on agape, which we other guys call the general welfare or the common good. The idea was to create a republic and a system of republics which would guarantee to humanity at last freedom of most people from the status of human cattle. Because in all known society, prior to the American Revolution and prior to the great 15th century Renaissance, which established the pathway to this revolution, most of mankind was either hunted, as wild cattle are hunted, or herded, bred, and culled, as herded cattle are kept as cattle. To free man from his cattle-like bestial status, to free the slave holder and the slave alike from that system, we needed a new form of society. A republic in which no one could be human cattle. And therefore, this republic was created on this continent for that mission for all mankind. A unique mission assigned to these people in this place at this time. A chosen people, if you please, and a chosen republic. That republic, that former republic, has served us well when we have served it well. By putting not prostitutes, but representatives into government. And thus the aspiration of an honest citizen is to free himself from being a kind, a species of cattle known as a populist. Yeah? A bipolar cow. whose attitudes and sex are undetermined. Yeah? So the point is we must be citizens and think of ourselves individually as representatives of the rulers of this planet. Not each as a ruler of this planet, but we are responsible for this planet. We are probably also responsible for this universe. That we will have to settle. We discover that or not. But we know that we are responsible for this planet. That means we are citizens. That means while we live, we do things which are in honor and respect for our predecessors, their sufferings and their achievements, and in our obligation to our posterity. That we are concerned with the welfare and development of all humanity, in every part of humanity. We desire no empire, but rather an order among nations, of republics, of sovereign republics, who share a community of principle, a principle of dedication to this purpose, that no man shall be human cattle. And therefore we as citizens represent the highest rank of living being on this planet. And having that rank entails responsibilities. We are responsible for mankind. We must create and renew a form of government which fulfills that mission, that intention, that purpose. And therefore, we should love our government and make it good, because we have under our Constitution the authority and the obligation to make it good. If your politician stinks, it's your responsibility. If the laws are bad, you must cause them to be changed. If injustice is perpetrated, you must cause it to be corrected. You are the one whose turns. You are like the case of the Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. You are the Good Samaritan. You are the person to whom society must turn for succor when man is in jeopardy, when anyone is in jeopardy. If you can't do it yourself, organize somebody else to help it get the job done. That's government. Now, also, there's another aspect of this thing which is extremely important, which you have to understand before you come to the subject of understanding what's called basic economic infrastructure. And that is, what is it that defines a human being as better than an animal? What's the difference between Al Gore and a baboon? He may not, when he gets down on all fours and walks, you may have trouble finding the difference, but nonetheless, he is, all things considered, technically human. And what should he have been? Having been born human, what should he have become rather than perhaps what he became? What is there about man, the individual person, that is special? If man were an animal, say a baboon or something like that, a higher ape, under the conditions which we know from the past 2 million years, of the known ice age developments, the human population of this planet could never have exceeded several million living individuals. Then why do we have going on 6 billion individuals living on this planet now? No animal could do that. What is it about man that qualifies man to increase man's power per capita in and over the universe, as no other species can do? Every other species is condemned to an apparent genetic determination of their potential to adapt to an environment. Only mankind can willfully overcome that limitation, and has. What is it? Well, Plato described that in the Collected Dialogues, the principle of Socratic discovery. Of Socratic hypothesis. When we face an error or simply ignorance as a contradiction, a paradox, the human individual mind is capable, as Plato demonstrates in the Socratic dialogues, of seeing the fallacy in prevailing opinion up to then, and discovering an hypothesis which will solve that paradox. An able man to conquer that paradox, provided that man is able to demonstrate that the hypothesis is true. Sometimes we call these discoveries universal physical principles. And they come in many forms. They come in the form of what we call physics, physical science. They come in the form also of social relations. Because to organize society, you have to look at not only what man is capable of doing as an individual, you have to see how these ideas on which the power, the increase of the power of man in the universe is increased. You have to see these powers and see how the fruits of these powers are transmitted from previous generations to the present. For example, how can a child living today re-experience the act of discovery performed by Archimedes prior to 212 BC? That the this is true of all we know. We are dependent upon our predecessors, which are many. We come from many parts of the world for our ideas. And the cultural transmission of discoveries of principle, like hypotheses, like universal physical principles, from one generation to the next, the development of forms of cooperation by which these ideas are discovered, transmitted, and applied, this is humanity. So therefore, through this quality that makes us special, we are able to master the universe increasingly as no other species can. And it is these processes, it is the exchanges of these kinds of ideas through which man increases his power over the universe and preserves that knowledge from one generation to the next, that we are human. And those qualities of social relations which depend upon that are precious, the things that make us different than the beast. And we see ourselves then in the likeness of the Creator. We see that we are endowed with that kind of creative power we recognize through the discovery of, for example, universal physical laws. These are the laws of the universe. They are universal. They are universal throughout the universe. We know these laws in a certain way, by a process of discovery, a Socratic process of discovery. Therefore, we know these laws not because somebody sold them to us or described, we looked it up on the internet. We know these laws because we have reenacted the discovery of that knowledge. Therefore, we understand that as knowledge, and we understand that as the knowledge shared with the Creator. And thus we find ourselves in the image of the Creator. And we have a moral sense of the obligation and what our morality must be because of that connection. So therefore, a society which is soundly organized includes a society of entrepreneurs, not joint stock corporations. They're detestable things that have to be managed. They're like wild beasts, and you must fence them in and herd them and watch them, or they will tear down the fences and eat all the crops and everything else. They're terrible things. Stock corporations, you may need them, but you've got to watch them and you've got to manage them tightly. A cattle prodder, too, may help. As recent experience may have suggested to you. But the entrepreneur is a different creature. The joint stock corporate leader tends to be a parasite. They're out there for what they can get and not for what they can give. An entrepreneur, as I've known them, are really not greedy fellows. They may have some tendency in that direction. Maybe their wife nags them too much or something of that sort. But they're generally not greedy fellows. A true entrepreneur who's successful, first of all, is embodied with a certain kind of creativity. They intend to do something. They intend to achieve something. They're frustrated. They don't want to sit back and just get money as an employee. They want to do something in society. They have a dedication, a mission. They enjoy it. Now, what they have to do, the problem is they want to do their mission. They have to survive while doing it. And being human, they would like to transmit this thing that they're contributing to society afterward, especially, hopefully, to members of their immediate family who will take over the enterprise from them or something of that sort. or adopt some young guy who is promising, the kids don't want the job, they want the business, give it to him. Keep the thing going. Make a contribution to society. Like the farmer, the independent farmer, who improves production, who improves the quality of the crop, who will sweat all kinds of hours to save a crop because of a seasonal disturbance, get the hay in before the rain comes. Things of that sort. Entrepreneurs, people who express the truly human quality of creativity and apply it energetically to do some good and demand only, let us make a little money to keep the show going and to expand it in the meantime. This has always been the gut of the American system. This is what the socialists never quite understood. The entrepreneur, the creative individual who is motivated to do good, to serve the common good, who wants to accomplish something good, who has chosen a career to do good, to make a better machine, to apply the profession with greater skill, to conquer a disease, or to do something of that sort. A sense of mission. I am a body in trajectory on a mission. I have an intention. And let me keep going and do my mission. And when I pass on, let somebody else continue that mission which I've embarked upon. Now that's the gut of the American system.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's keynote address at the Labor Day 2002 conference of the ICLC and Schiller Institute. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.